think I've ever played in a game where you didn't have...
Somebody saying something about your mother.
Yeah, exactly. Or whatever else I could find to get under your skin. It's like, you know, how long has this guy played organized sports? I mean, he's a professional. He's been in, what, the European League for 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
He's played, you know, club sports, whatever else, all this time. This has never happened to him before. This guy's got some special talent.
It was for Mother France.
Oh, God.
It was for all our mothers and sisters in the motherland of France that I broke that guy's sternum.
I was going to say, it would have helped the mothers and sisters and daughters a whole lot more had he gone out and kicked a goal that won the world championship for him.
My sentiments, exactly. He's the best penalty kicker on their team because he's got those big feet. He's 6'1". He's a skinny guy with big feet. He can really spin the ball, you know. Mm-hmm. You can put a lot on it when you have a big foot surface to go against the ball.
He did in the one penalty kick.
Yes, talk about skill. He pulled that guy right out of his shoes.
Yeah.
And not only that, but with Zidane in the center at the end of two overtimes and the Italians completely exhausted from playing defense for 115 minutes, there was every chance that that one last bit of pressure on goal would have gotten them a goal. But they weren't going to accomplish it a man down. And they were down as soon as Zidane had his temper tantrum. And he went back home, and the French kind of bucked up, and Chirac said thank you, and they gave him the golden ballon as the player of the tournament. And
yeah, which it looks like they may take back.
Really?
Well,
I hadn't heard that. But I guess if they'd finished this investigation and decide to give him some kind of real citation. Well, he's retiring from international play anyway, so that doesn't matter. But what a way to go out after being the hero of your country. I mean, he's the guy that practically single-handedly won the World Cup in 98.
Well,
and then they beat the Italians in that international championship in 2000.
Can you just imagine, though, somewhere Beckham is in a pub having a pint and going, hey, I'm off the hook.
I'm not Zinedine Zidane. The English have a Frenchman to kick around.
Oh, God. What was that? I remember a story long ago, and I don't remember the player's name now, but it was a Peter Gammon story.
Uh-huh.
And he was at the game the year that, you know, the Mets and the Red Sox are in the World Series, and the ball goes through Bill Buckner's legs. Well, years before the Red Sox are in the World Series, and they lost a game on a dramatic, you know, game-ending homer that was given up by a particular pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And the pitcher, up to that 1986 game, was the most vilified man in Boston.
That's right. He got over his alcoholism problem that year.
Oh, my gosh. So there he happened to be in the stadium, too.
No
and
kidding.
Gammon says the only guy smiling in the stadium was this pitcher who came up to me and said, hey, I'm off the hook.
Well, given who Beckham is married to, I guess he needs something to smile about.
Oh, goodness gracious. I think he's got plenty to smile about. He especially has it now because nobody is it's like, okay, it could have been worse. You could have done what Zidane did.
That's right. Anyway, it was kind of a shocking ending, but my wife works with a bunch of Italians, and we've been to Rome a time or two to go visit. I always rode along with her on the business trips, you know, got a red eye on the local airline so I could go and tour the ruins of classic Rome while she went to business meetings all day. And so I've met these guys and had dinner with them, and she talked to them one morning on the phone after the World Cup, and they were all hoarse.
Oh, God, don't doubt it.
Hello, Suzanne. It's nice to talk to you. You would know they were in St. Peter's Square the night before till 3 o'clock
in
the morning.
I'm actually shocked they were in the office the next day.
It was kind of exciting. I enjoyed the World Cup. We were over in Europe, of course, the last World Cup in 2002. I watched almost every game of it. It was broadcast on BBC and on quite a few local Belgian and French channels, all of which I could get. So I kind of became a closet fan of football, which is now soccer again for me because I've come home and remembered what football actually is.
Well, it's not a bad thing because, you know, at Brewing Frog Manor, we do occasionally, if there's just seemingly nothing else on, which, oddly enough, even with a satellite dish, there really isn't a whole lot on. That
57
just,
channels and there's nothing on.
Yeah, that's it. Pretty wretched. But I'll just flip over to whatever the Spanish stations are, and what do you know? They got Mexican League soccer going on.
That's right, and you don't need a translator.
There, yeah.
Especially when they score. Get it, get it, get it, get should give him an award for lung capacity.
Somewhere they've got a wing in the broadcast museum for guys like that. It's just like extra lung capacity.
Longest utterance of gola.
Goal. Yeah.
Goal. So I was looking at the Drudge Report all week for the Drudge Headline of the Week Award, and I think I have it here. Iraqi leader warns biased media outlets. So the president of the newly formed government of Iraq is warning the TV stations and the newspapers not to incite sectarianism and not to come down on any one particular side of these public political discussions. And reading the headline, warning biased media outlets, I wished with all my heart that our leader could warn our biased media outlets.
What? They're taking sides? I'm shocked. Shocked.
There's a man named Stuart Levy who's an undersecretary of something or other in charge of financial links to terrorism. He's working very hard on the SWIFT program up until Bill Keller outed it. And Levy's congressional testimony before a subcommittee this week is now on the record. Ah. He says it absolutely did great harm to the business of rooting out terrorist financial transactions to reveal this program. There was no reason to do it because all these lawyers from all these different agencies had worked so hard to make sure it passed every muster. There wasn't any judge anywhere that said the program was even capable of wrongdoing, let alone had it ever been accused of wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. And Bill Keller said that President Bush didn't want it published because he was, quote, embarrassed that his administration can't keep a secret, unquote. But here's what
Among Levy's, other reasons, yes.
Levy's testimony said, in the last 2 years, I've read the output from this program every morning, and there has not been a day when we have not found a lead to terrorist financial activity through this program.
I don't doubt it.
Up till now.
What is interesting to me is, it's continually surprising, though it shouldn't be, although I guess the surprise part of it is just, you know, that I'm continuing to be amazed by it, is the ignorance and stupidity of members of the media who ought to know better.
I've decided that Bill Keller is like Hitler, that Bill Keller is the world's worst terrorist. This is the things they say about Bush. I've decided it's Bill Keller that way, and here's why. Keller is a victim of Bush derangement syndrome.
BDS.
Everything is all right as long as it helps further the taking down of George Bush. There's no moral rule at work in him that is a higher rule or a higher principle than must take down Bush.
To hang that particular yoke on just Bill Keller alone as if he's hauling the wagon all by himself.
Yeah, but he's the spokesman for them.
Yeah, he's just the guy that's currently in the spotlight. He is the executive editor of The Gray Lady, etc. But it's not like he's got literally thousands of minions at other newspapers around the country who are cheering him on through this entire thing.
This is true, but he's just
the lightning rod du jour.
And in being the lightning rod and trying to explain the reasonableness of his actions, he's just come off smug and arrogant.
Yes. Well,
and so you have to assume he's speaking for them.
Well, you can go about this two ways when the light suddenly shines on you. You can scurry away like a cockroach, or you can try and brazen it out. And he's chosen option B. And his actions are irrespective of what he's done. He's just going to brazen it out. And you know why he can get away with it? Who's going to tell you about it? His brother minions in the media.
Isn't that the truth? With a few notable exceptions, you know, and I think they're acting to call them on the carpet in their own quiet way. Fox News, I'm amazed how hard they try to actually be neutral. Which we report, you decide. They claim not to take sides. And you would think with all the thoroughgoing side-taking in the rest of the media that Fox would want to lean the other way just to balance the ship. But really, they don't. They just give you information.
And this is one thing that I find interesting in that, yeah, they are trying to shoot down the middle. And I find it funny that they're characterized and pigeonholed as, oh, they're just right-wing news or faux news or, you know, whatever else, you know, the lefties.
Well, that's because on the far left, they think they're in the middle, and there is nobody to the left of them, but anyone to the right of them is suspect because they're middle. When you're on the left, there's only middle, yourself, and right, as in far-right, maniacal, right-wing neocon.
Yes, really. And so the left sees rule.
Bush lied, people died, no blood for oil, Halliburton, ooga booga booga.
Where do I put my club?
But truly, they think Fox is on the right simply because they think they are in the middle.
Well, one thing I always found interesting is how does the media work in terms of programming? You think, okay, well, over here is the Super Bowl. That's what all the guys are watching. What else do we, put on? We don't have the Super Bowl. Hey, right. Let's put on, you know, girl programming. They're all wanting to watch something. Counter-programming. You know, why did Fox rise so meteorically? Well, because there was a great hunger for news that was not biased.
It's just a repeat in television of the Rush Limbaugh story in radio.
Indeed.
Somebody came on that wasn't to the left, or as they consider themselves, in the middle.
Yeah.
And because they weren't, people flocked to them because finally here's an alternative to the only thing we could find on TV for the last 30 years.
There it is, an alternative.
And even if it's not hardcore right-wing propaganda, and it's not, it seems like that to the media on the left because from where they are, it's such a great distance to come over on the political spectrum to where Fox is.
What surprises me is, okay, with the success of Fox News and the huge viewership numbers that they're raking in every ratings period, why hasn't there been somebody else do this? That passeth all understanding. If it worked once, it'll probably work again.
The business model is still out there begging for someone else to come and compete from that position because there's still room. Come on in. The water's still fine.
Big time.
But no one will do it.
Yeah, talk radio is still growing.
Talk radio is still growing. Television is still growing for anyone who chooses to do it, not from the perspective of the left. But the story, as Robbie is saying here, is how many of the big TV programming powerhouse companies, and there are a lot in America and in the world, simply will not take that position, even though it's clearly the lucrative position today.
Yeah, gosh. Who are your news people? Who's dead last in the news rankings right now? CBS?
Hey. Yeah, but it's close. They're duking it out for that spot.
Yeah, all of them have an anchor on their necks, and they're going down.
Anchor, but that's a funny name for that person.
Indeed.
Like the millstone, the biblical millstone.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, down they go. Glub, 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 glub. But I find it funny. It's like if you're an executive with this network, and you've got zillions of shareholders who are screaming their lungs out that their share prices are dropping like proverbial millstone in pond.
Yep.
Hello, news division. You guys are an anchor. Everybody down there is fired. Clean out your desk. Security will escort you out. Let's hire a slew of new people. I mean, what could it possibly hurt? Like, the ratings get any lower?
Well, I don't think there's any better proof of the entrenched leftism of the mainstream media than the fact that even faced with the prospect of failure in their current model and huge profitability and success in the Fox News model, that you just can't get any of them to step forward and get with the program, even though it's there for the taking.
It is.
They'd rather compete with Fox News on a purely financial basis than with the other 15 cable news channels that are all on the left and competing with each other for a shrinking audience. But Fox News has no competitors.
Indeed.
Because no one will do it on an ideological basis. They can't make themselves step over their ideology and pick up the pile of money that's sitting on the table.
Yeah, I find it interesting also, if you look at it historically in terms of how newspapers used to work, like when you had 6 or 7 newspapers in a large metropolitan
or
city.
Even 2 like we used to have.
We used to. Yeah, and it was funny. Even then, you had what we considered the right-leaning newspaper and the left-leaning newspaper. Mm-hmm. The left-leaning newspaper, of course, went belly up and was bought by the other newspaper, who then quickly flipped
became
over leftward.
Left-leaning.
Yeah, go figure. And now you got no outlet. And I find it interesting. Back in the day, of course, I wasn't alive then.
Right.
But, before television, before all these things, when you had these many dailies and whatnot, what you had was, you had the right-wing and the left-wing newspapers. You had, the conservative paper, the liberal paper.
Britain still have those. They got the Times and the Telegraph and the Guardian, and everybody who picks up a paper in Britain knows which wing they're buying.
Oh, in Britain, yes.
Yeah.
Here, no.
No. Although you got to say the New York Post, as tabloid-ish.
Or the Sun.
As tabloid-ish as it is, it might be the one that people perceive as leaning the other way. And
that
explains its growth while the Times shrinks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think that this great hunger is for an alternative. Counter-programming, if you will, is the one thing that drives talk radio, that drives the explosive growth of the net, the blogosphere, all these different opinion methods of instruction that just continue to explode. And it simply baffles the old-time business model, the buggy whip model, if you will, of old journalism, old television, old media.
They're going to have to get used to it. The world changed geopolitically when the Soviet Union failed and the world became fully aware for the first time in the last 15 years of how badly socialism and communism went as a model for the business of a nation, how completely failed they are economically, socially, everything fell apart. The Russians, you know, average age of death for men is down below 60 now, and almost all of them die from alcohol-related symptoms. I mean, it's just a terrible thing. A blight of communism and socialism on people is just now starting to be fully understood after the 15 years since the wall fell. And I think that the political view from the left that drives governments to positions like that is the same view that drives newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, Newsweek, Time Magazine, MSNBC, CBS, NBC, ABC.
The usual CNN. Suspects.
Ran out of breath there. That's the same political philosophy that drives those people, and they're wondering why their audiences are going down. I think it's just the same thing. It's just a general worldwide awareness of the relative merits of different worldviews, which were squashed in a very big way in the 70s and the 80s. People didn't understand how badly the Soviets were doing because they kept all their secrets. And now that we know how badly they did and we understand that that worldview is essentially a failure on all levels, that it's getting less and less credence from Americans as a whole in other areas, and the media is a big one.
I find it so interesting. Anyway, way back, you know, in the day, again, you know, pre-1989, I had quite a bit of business over in Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And would travel there frequently. And on one trip, you know, and you knew what was happening over there. You talked to people and, you know, hey, what's going to happen with this anyway? Because everyone knew that the Soviet Union was just collapsing. Enough cards been pulled from the base that the structure was beginning to collapse.
But they were also worried about what they would do in their death throes, and they were very glad Reagan had our missiles over
exactly,
there.
Exactly, yes. And I remember the protests against those, too. Weren't they misguided? So there we were, and they said, you'd better go to Berlin while it still is, so you can see it as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the future, it's going to be something completely different. And sure enough, there we were. Checkpoint Charlie, the whole...
Well, the Brandenburg Gate used to be the opening of the Black Abyss.
Oh, yeah. What used to be City Hall, which is now filled with the monuments of all the people the East German Border Guard shot while trying to escape tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
I still find it amazing that if you go to that place and you look at it and you think, oh, God, I can't believe that could possibly have happened. And yet it did. People lived it. That was their life. I was talking to a young West German girl, Berliner, and she just, I said, what are you going to do with the rest of the wall? This is, I guess, 2 years after it fell.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, we're going to leave this one section up just as a monument as to what it was so that people don't forget, because everybody seems to be forgetting about it now. And that really is a danger. You have to remember these things. She says, I wish we could tear it down and forget it ever existed, but it needs to stand there as a lesson.
The Israeli slogan for the last 50 years has been never again, always remember, never forget. And guess what? Now we have world leaders making speeches that the Holocaust didn't happen. I mean, 50 years.
One of whom is doing his darndest to get nuclear weapons.
No sooner do the elders of the generation that knew the horror start to die away than there is a powerful political force trying to change history, trying to alter what happened so that people won't remember it. And it's so consistent. It doesn't matter what situation. The changing of the next generation's understanding of history is something that always, always you find some powerful group trying to cause. You know, the communists always said, we got control of the schools. We let our little kids grow up knowing that they have to turn in their parents if they find, you know, a Bible under daddy's bed or something. Mm. I mean, that's how you control the future, is by controlling how children are taught. And that's the way it worked in the Soviet Union, and sadly, with the national teachers' unions, that's the way it works here.
Well, and curriculum. And, well, then the lack of history education, which amazes me.
That's the worst thing, is the history.
I don't even know what they're teaching in school, to be very honest. I'm not a school-age kid anymore. I haven't been for a long time. Don't really know any kids that are in school. Hey, little Johnny, what did you learn in school today?
How to put a condom on a cucumber.
Oh, my gosh.
That's right. And how to pray in Arabic. They can teach that religion in public school.
This is a hijab, yeah. This is a burqa. Passeth all understanding.
But hopefully things are changing, because the public is becoming aware in ways that they never had the opportunity
to
be aware of.
And why are they becoming aware of this? Because you and I are talking about it, other people are talking about it, and we're not part of the usual suspect media. That's the only way it gets out.
Rush Limbaugh came first, then came the internet, the blogosphere, and talk radio in general exploding shortly after Rush Limbaugh, and now they have lost their grip.
The dam has broken.
On public information, and they never will get it back again because too many people know too much.
Well, it's again, you know, we were talking about, you know, the wall came down. Why did it come down? Because simply the power of freedom. Once people get a taste of it, it is an unstoppable force. There was nothing that could have held that back. The East Germans knew it. Everybody knew it. At the time, they just, it wasn't if, it was when. Everyone knew it was going to happen. It had an inevitability and, inertia all of its own.
And I'm beginning to believe, as difficult as it has been to believe in the last few years, that same power, as George Bush has so many times said, is starting to catch on in the Middle East.
Oh.
That general, ordinary, public people, not terrorists, not political activists, not Baathists, not Muslim fiends, ordinary, millions of ordinary people are starting to dream and imagine what life would be like if Iraq were only half the democracy that the United States is.
Indeed. Well, that's something that somebody has said. And the, for example, the Reformation that occurred on the plains of Europe in, the 1300s, when suddenly a little bit of freedom came into what was at that time a very rigid hierarchy of ecumenical authority, if you will. And now there are literally Muslim scholars that are calling for this now in the Muslim world, a reformation. Of course, these guys are probably going to be killed, but at least there are calls for it. And unlike, 700-800 years ago, when you did not have, the mass media, when all you could do was, take a handbell and, nail it to the door of a certain church, like Martin Luther did, these many centuries ago.
The 95 Theses.
Exactly. Now you've got the ability for somebody to post something on a website or something else, and literally millions can see it. And the change will take place within them.
And the governments of these Arab countries that have been in charge for so many years in one form or another really are against their own people. They control knowledge. They prevent people from getting a taste of freedom that might encourage them to try for some other form of government. Mm-hmm. These people are, much like Kim Jong-il is right now, completely obsessed with one thing only, and that is keeping themselves in power.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not the government that people would choose if they were able to choose their own. They get to the top, and then they don't want to leave, and they begin to believe, like the communists always believed, that everyone is better off when we're in power because we're the smart ones, and the decisions we make are best for everybody. So whatever we have to do to stay in power, we're going to do it because it's better for everyone. There is no tyrant who ever willingly set down the scepter and the crown and walked away from it and said, somebody else take over, I'm through, for the good of the people. They never give up. Kim Jong-il will have to be killed because he will never give up power.
Well, it'd have to be killed, or perhaps natural causes will take their effect. I saw the other day, interesting little factoid, for a very short time, a Spanish version of AP had a headline, Fidel Castro dead.
That's right, another death rumor this week.
Yeah, all of a sudden, here it goes, and it's awfully quiet coming out of Havana these days. And, I just wonder, are there Lear jets loaded up with gold bars flying to Switzerland right now out of Havana?
Well, his brother Raul is the natural takeover guy, but he's older than Fidel.
Yes.
Fidel's the younger brother. And they've been in power together, Raul as the quiet one, for 50 years?
Raul runs the secret police.
Since the mid-1950s?
Yes.
And people don't live forever. And the Castro brothers are going to be out of power, and it's going to be soon because they can't outrun Father Time. And what do you think is going to happen in Cuba then?
I think it will be a very short and bloody interregnum, but I do believe that you're going to have a lot of people out of Miami show up down there with a great lot of money.
And campaign posters.
Yes.
Blank ones. So they can teach people how to run for office and run a democracy.
It'll take a little while for that to occur, too. But that country has been very restive for some time now. And Castro has only been able to keep power by ruthlessly stamping out anything.
And now he's getting help from Chavez, the oil tycoon, and billions of dollars coming up from the South because Chavez has a huge investment in Castro's ability to hang on to power so he can get a leg up 90 miles from our shore.
Yes, that's true. But what's going to happen? Because, again, here's a people yearning for freedom. Here they have relations in Miami and all over South Florida that have been itching for a chance to get back for, again, these many years. But they're all going to come screaming back.
You wonder what Chavez will do, though, when he's probed and pushed
He's having a tough enough time hanging on in Venezuela.
I don't know. Don't give Chavez too little credit. He had a lot to do with the Mexican election being so close and the leftists down there coming so near to taking power. Can you imagine what would happen if Chavez had an arm-in-arm socialist thug buddy where he could put Venezuelan soldiers right on our border? You think the president would wake up and order military to our Texas border then?
No. No, I don't think so.
No,
it's interesting you say about Lopez Obrador and what happened there in that election. I find it interesting that he really did as much as he possibly could to get that man in office. I guess the one good thing that happened for us and bad thing that happened for Hugo was that he didn't have Jimmy Carter there to certify the election.
And I wonder what happened. Is old Jimma not feeling too well?
I'm not quite sure what's up with Jim. Maybe he had another birthday to attend.
Maybe he was in the middle of writing another anti-Bush screed.
Oh, quite possibly. No, the reason I make the joke about having a birthday to attend is the last election that was held in Venezuela was, Hugo was most likely going to lose. And they made very careful that they had an independent electoral board. It only had a certain amount of Hugo's people. And it had other people that were not connected to Hugo. In fact, were not really friends of Hugo. They were friends of freedom. And Hugo is quite much against freedom. Well, here comes the election returns. All of the canvassing and everything that had been done showed that Hugo had lost by about 10%.
Uh-huh.
Very bad for Hugo. Well, Hugo's election judges kicked out the other election judges, were going to count the ballots. Well, normally you would think that an international observer looking at this would say, that's not good.
Hello, America, I'm an international observer.
Exactly, and Jimma sat there and watched him kind of says, that's a free and fair election. Hugo, you're president again. And he hopped on a plane and left because he said, I have a birthday party to go to.
Jimma Carter claims to be a humble Christian man. He quotes the Bible regularly in these anti-Bush screed books that he writes. I saw one on the shelf the other day at... Where's the place where you have to get a card to go in and shop in bulk? What is the name of that big shop where you buy, 17,000 cans of soup wrapped in plastic?
Costco or Sam's?
Sam's, that's it. Mm-hmm. Sam's Club. Yeah, I was in there and I saw a Jimma Carter book and I picked it up and I read about six pages and there were three Bible quotes there, obviously aimed at President Bush, trying to show that Bush was not a real Christian. And I think this man is down there standing on a podium in Havana, shaking one of the most blood-stained hands of the 20th century and telling everyone that George Bush was a terrorist. And I'm thinking, what kind of loss of grip of ethics and morality, and may I say the Bible, does it take for Jimmy Carter to be able to do that with a straight face? I mean, it's appalling.
I it's one of those things that I remember an author writing where he says, the mind reels.
That's right.
No, I don't understand it. I can't figure that out because I guess political philosophy of man, whatever, very Lockean in terms of it's all about freedom. You got to be free to do what you wish to do. And here's a guy who is quoting the Bible. So, a liberating theology.
Claiming he's a Christian, just as George Bush has done, but and when Jimma does it, it's not wrong.
Doing all he possibly can to put in, godless tyrants throughout the world.
That's right.
And to do everything he can to stop the greatest power for freedom in the world. What's wrong with this picture?
Jimmy Carter, when he got unelected in the 1980 election.
And it was a beautiful night.
Began to make regular visits to the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C., and God alone knows how many American secrets he gave up and how much of an effort he made to undermine and damage the Reagan administration right in the heart of the toughest part of the Cold War. But I'll guarantee you, Jimmy Carter has been a public enemy of this country for 25 years or more, and he's not slowing down.
No,
so where was he in Mexico? Come on, Jimma. Drop the peanuts and get back to work. We don't know what to make of you anymore.
Perhaps, who knows? I've given up thinking about Jimmy. It's better if I don't.
What else will we talk about?
Oh, God. Let's see. I actually wrote a couple of things down here. Let's see.
I hate to talk about the Israelis because things could change so much between now and the week.
Gosh, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, the other thing I was going to think about was what Novak had to say, but I think he's going to have a lot more to say this evening on the Brit Hume show. I think that's going to be, oh, good Lord.
Oh, he's going to give it all
splotch
away.
Splotch top. Well, he already wrote a column where he said quite a bit, but he, now that the column's out, now Britt can ask him some more, you know. Only intelligent guy in media right now is Britt Hume, I think, and here he's going to be asking him questions. And I think that will be very illuminating.
Okay. All right. Here we go on Novak. So Novak has revealed that even though he's not telling us who his primary source is, that he used his primary source to confirm something that he had already found out for himself, that is to say, the name of Valerie Plame, secret agent Valerie Plame. And you know where he found it? In the Who's Who entry next to Joseph Wilson. Who's Who published in order to inflate the credentials of and puff up the ego of whoever is in there. And Joseph Wilson could just as easily have put Valerie Wilson as his wife's name in Who's Who, but he put Valerie Plame in there, which is the name that she used as a CIA operative.
Yeah.
So Joseph Wilson is the person who publicly published, for his own arrogant braggadocio purposes, the name of his wife, the CIA agent, and Bob Novak just looked it up. But then he went to the White House and asked, is Valerie Plame Joseph Wilson's wife? And, yeah. And that's it. That's it. Fitzgerald knew this early going. Fitzgerald knew who had confirmed to Joseph Wilson who Valerie Plame was. He also understood that they were not attempting to cause problems for anyone and that they were not violating any laws of espionage or revealing agents' names or anything. He hasn't brought any prosecution against anyone. He hasn't charged anyone. He wasn't thinking of this for the last 2 years of this Fitzgerald investigation. Bob Novak's information that he revealed this week is well known to Fitzgerald, and he's not acting on it. So why is there an investigation? Why is there an investigation?
Because all the usual suspect media people all screamed and hollered for one. That's why.
That's right. Now, and you know why they were saying it? They were saying leaks over intelligence matters are a dreadfully serious thing and must be dealt with.
Oh, we can't do that.
That was the media line during the Plame case.
Oh, yeah. Well, If hypocrisy was an ice cream flavor, they'd be delivering truckloads of it, don't you think?
It'd be making the floor sticky.
Would you like some cherries on top of that with your chocolate sauce?
Right about now. So Bob Novak is going to come out of this with his dignity and his reputation intact because he didn't tell any lies. He didn't give anyone up in exchange for a plea bargain. All the things that everyone has been saying he did to get out from under this case are not true.
They're going to find a new way to dump on Bob Novak. They're going to find a new angle to dump on him.
Well, he's already thrown down the headset and microphone and stalked off a set with Carville and Begala saying political inanities that weren't true.
I was going to say, just about every word they utter, including A, N, and the, is pretty much a lie. I don't know why he would have bothered to go on the set with those guys in the first place.
And about a week later, he showed up on Fox News. So you can tell Bob Novak has had enough of principle-free people.
Mm.
And it's nice to know that his principles were at work throughout this whole case and that there is, as we long suspected, nothing to it. And I hope Scooter Libby gets off because I don't think he did anything wrong.
I don't believe so either, because essentially the word that what they have him in for is essentially perjury, that he said something, he either contradicted himself between rounds of grand jury testimony or somebody else said something that contradicted something that he said.
And I'm still having trouble understanding how you can bring a prosecution for perjury in an investigation of a crime that is now known to not have existed.
Yes.
The investigation came up with nothing. So what was he perjuring himself about?
There's going to be an interesting burden of proof on this.
You've got to assume that somebody who commits perjury has some motive.
Well, indeed.
But there's no crime. So what motive could he possibly have except maybe he forgot what he said or misunderstood something?
Oh, indeed. Well, you got two things happening here. He contradicted himself during different days of testimony in front of the grand jury, or two, somebody else contradicted something he said. Now, if it's case A, well, okay, perhaps he was confused. That's a distinct possibility. He could always have done the Clinton, I don't recall, and gotten away with it.
Depends on what the meaning of is,
yes. Or in the case of somebody contradicted him, who would that have been? Most likely it would have been a reporter. Who would that reporter be?
Well, let's see. Judy Miller? No, she's already been to jail. One of those male reporters is married to one of the principals in this case.
Ah, yes, indeed.
The bald-headed guy. I can't remember his name.
There's several others that are all linked up.
It's incestuous, isn't it?
Yes, very much so.
The media and the Washington bureaucracy are all intermarried like different races breeding together, and it's as ugly, as incestuous a snake pit as you can find. I remember being astounded when I found out that the federal banking chairman guy, Greenspan, was married to Andrea Mitchell of NBC News. You think she gets scoops?
Well, you know, I found an odd match there because, you know, I always thought she didn't look all that bad. And good Lord, Greenspan? Oh, man. Talk about stop a clock in three separate counties at one time. Yikes.
Yeah, but can you imagine the platinum MasterCard that come with that
No, he carries the Centurion card, baby.
But there's always a reporter married to an official somewhere, and you don't find out about it until it's too late. Or in the case of the now uncovered leaker from the CIA, this Mary, that they fired?
Mary McCarthy.
Mary McCarthy. She left the CIA when George Bush got elected and went into a Democrat think tank and became an activist. And in 2004, she reapplies, and they hired her again.
Why, of course they did.
Idiots. She just reapplied to be a mole. She dug back into the bureaucracy, started revealing the secrets, and kept her lips zipped about what she was doing. She was not a whistleblower. She was a spy. A whistleblower takes a stand, goes public, has a press conference. I'm resigning my position today because I'm disturbed by what takes place in this office. What happens, happens. I can't stay here anymore. Because she didn't do any of that. She didn't tell anyone who she was. She just stayed burrowed in there and kept the leaks coming.
Her and how many others? See, yeah. one of the great, and see, this is an interesting object lesson in hardball politics,
mm-hmm.
and what one party can get away with and another party cannot because of, you know, who's doing the telling.
Yep.
When the Clinton crime family, I'm sorry, the Clinton administration came in, they very publicly and quickly fired every sitting United States attorney. They fired everybody who served at the pleasure of the president they could possibly find.
Billy Dale, the White House travel agent, got sacked.
They got rid of people they probably shouldn't have.
And they brought charges against Billy Dale that weren't real just to make him go away.
He was just one. There were others.
Talk about arm twisting.
They put their goons and their cronies in position, and the only reason those people were put in those positions is loyalty, not any type of ability or anything else, loyalty. Throughout his entire 8 years of being, you know, running things there, they did all they could to stuff the bureaucracy. Not positions that were serving at the pleasure of the president.
Only those that knew things that needed to be known.
Yes, but put them into permanent bureaucratic positions where they could not be fired due to civil service things.
Mm-hmm.
So here comes the Bush administration. Dum-da-dum-da-da. And they decide that they're going to have a new tone, and they're not going to govern like past administrations. So they left all these people in place.
It's like an anthill under the front step to your house.
Gosh, well, yeah, and here they're surprised and shocked. Shocked. That there's leaks coming on from the CIA, from the State Department. Well, what do you expect? They're all full of, you know, loyal Clinton people.
And so far, there's only one Clintonista corpse to come out of there, and that's Mary McCarthy. And there must be another 100 or 1,000 in the CIA and the State Department.
The there's the one of the big guys at CIA who was noted to be a problem child. Well, he got run out by Porter Goss. They sent Porter Goss in there with the, you're clean the thing up. It's a swamp, all
and
right?
And he's writing books now, isn't he?
Well, no. Goss decided he just had enough. He wouldn't get any support from the Bush people because he was essentially doing what they said, clean things up. He smoked out McCarthy, got rid of her. He smoked out the Cervella, got rid of him. So he had several others he wanted to get rid of, and the Bush people were giving him no support. They were running for the high, you know, the high grass because the Washington Post might say something naughty about us. You know, like, you know, what town do you think you're working in here, guys? But anyway, so they're going to put this fellow Michael Hayden in charge of things, which, yeah, good choice, bad choice, I don't know. But his first move has not been a promising one. This, you know, Clintonite troublemaker, they've just decided that, well, the bureaucracy sure likes the guy. Now we're going to make him the deputy director.
You're kidding me.
I kid you not. And it's just, you know, what are you thinking? You're going to make peace with these people?
You don't promote somebody to get them out of the way in the CIA. It just puts them more in the way.
Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah, that's what was a promising start for Hayden, I think, is now going to be just another.
It's kind of disturbing that there's such obvious criminal activity going on in these agencies, and no one seems the least bit interested in chasing them down from the point of view of the Justice Department.
Well, the Justice Department has to follow someone's orders.
They are under the direction of the president, as
indeed.
I recall.
Indeed. I think you need, publicly, if he came out and said, you know, Alberto, put a team together, find the leakers, you know, run those goats to ground. Will he? No, I don't think so. I believe he feels he has bigger fish to fry.
But the frying is difficult when there's so many efforts to keep the oil cold.
Yeah. The frying pan's not even near the fire just yet.
That's right.
Oh, dear, dear, dear.
Yeah, that's kind of appalling. It's like you wonder, what is he thinking? He's got this intelligence group that, you know, half of them are fighting the other half and undermining him and leaking the secrets that he needs. And it's like, hello, what do you want to pick that up for and use it as a tool when you haven't cleaned it off and tightened it up? You can't. You can't get anything accomplished.
Yeah.
Let's see. Hidden camera shows mice on airplane. Wait,
FCC to crack down on sports broadcasts?
Probably for disgusting language by the athlete.
Oh.
Let's see. Video. Oh. Whistleblower said we had to take the chairs off and everybody saw mice running around the floor.
767?
One of the week's great headlines, hidden camera video shows mice on airplane. It's the busy summer travel season. Families have vacations planned, but apparently one of the cleaning crews on one of the airlines at Kansas City International Airport got a little disturbed about the relatively unclean state of modern airliners today and planted some hidden cameras. And when they took the seats off to clean the plane, mice were scurrying around all over the place.
This is your captain speaking. We'll be flying at 525 miles per hour at a flight of at a height of 35,000 feet. Your in-flight meal today.
If you ordered the cheese sandwich, we'll be taking alternate orders for lunch.
We have rat tart, rat sorbet.
Albatross.
Lovely rat pudding.
Now, the whistleblower said workers found nests in air vents and dead mice inside emergency oxygen masks. Just pull down on this cord, take the mouse out of the mask, and put it over your face and breathe.
Mommy, there's a mouse in my... Oh, shut it.
Back in May, a caller had reported a mouse infestation in one of those calls to the FAA office where they complain. And the caller said that mice chewed through two wires and that American Airlines wasn't doing anything about getting rid of the mice. To say that, you know, knowledgeably, the caller would have had to see them on more than one flight.
Oh, my gosh.
Mice in airplanes.
A caller. So... do they say what airline this is?
Oh, yeah. I said it. American Airlines. I can beep this later, so don't worry about it.
Caller alleged American Airlines doing nothing about eradicating the mice. Just the one call. Yeah. I guess this is the same aircraft then. Wow. That's pretty awful.
Mice on airplanes involved.
Yep. Exterminators gave and American Airlines. Oh, my goodness.
In April, the plane was at JFK, where mechanics noted a mouse observed in the galley, waiting in line for the bathroom.
Right. He'll never get that little door clasp shut. How did he make it through security with those teeth, anyway?
Okay, what else we got?
Oh, gosh.
Apologizes for headbutt, may lose. Oh, let's do the FCC. Oh, I saw a report on Fox last night. They were talking to a guy outside the subway tunnel where they pulled everybody out of the smoke in Chicago. Yeah. Guy said, man, I was coughing up this black shit.
Yeah. Hello, live television.
Right. We go now to our local affiliate who's interviewing a passenger.
Oh,
you know,
God.
There was
shit
coming out of my throat.
Oh, God.
All right.
Those poor guys. 5 seconds and you've got a button over there, guys.
That's really. Right. Sportscasting has changed over the last 30 years because 30 years ago you didn't have to worry too much about dirty words coming out of the mouths of athletes while you're live on television. Today, they don't seem to care too much. And so the FCC is now combing air tapes for dirty words and planning to continue and increase a crackdown on on-air profanity. They've requested tapes from broadcasters that may include vulgar remarks from unruly spectators, coaches, and athletes at live sporting events. I remember many years ago, a Dallas Cowboys Super Bowl, where Michael Irvin, now a respected ESPN commentator, shouted out the S word when he was defending Barry Switzer as a coach after they had won the Super Bowl with Switzer standing on the sidelines with his hands in his pockets, not having to do a whole lot that season, which is why Irvin was defending him. But yeah, and I thought that was a watermark for me, television-wise, that the athletes no longer cared who heard them and what they were saying. It was all okay because of who they were. Michael, do you know who I am, Irvin?
Well, I can't say that I'm like, you know, Mr. Sports aficionado, but I do know this, that say 10 years ago, you didn't have the sidelines mic'd like you do now.
Well, there's that. But Irvin knew. He had a microphone in his hand and was talking to the Super Bowl audience. He knew.
Ah.
And that was, what, 12, 13 years ago? 1993, something like that?
93.
I've heard Shaquille O'Neal do this on broadcasts on the sidelines of basketball games with the microphone in his face. I've heard them, but they don't care anymore. The athletes don't care anymore. They leave it up to the networks to control it, and since the networks are live, they can't control it. Once it's gone, it's gone. Radio can use a delay. You never hear dirty words on conservative talk shows because all the liberals who call to say them get beeped out because there's a delay at work. You can't do a delay on television.
Why not?
Well, you can, but it doesn't work near as well.
Ah, okay.
Television has to be live. The action has to be at the moment.
Mm.
You never hear that stuff on the PGA Tour. You know, you never hear it.
I don't know about that. I've got one day to find out who did this and when it happened. But after a while, you watch golf tournaments. After a while, it kind of blend together. It's a bunch of guys golfing. Where are they golfing? Who knows? And you got the same, you know, commentators. Well, here's so and so. He's standing over his ball on the 14th green. This looks like a tough putt. He's got to go over the saddle here. Well, he's going to look at that putt for a while. Let's go to 16. And they go to something else. Here's a guy standing looking to get a golf ball. Wow, those are beautiful trees. He's going to look at the golf ball some more. Now let's go back to 14. Well, he's still looking at this putt.
A pigeon has just flown between two trees on the 12th fairway.
It's exciting.
Back to you, Jim.
Well, here we are at the clubhouse.
One of the best golf moments, though, and a moment the FCC probably could take back if they were trying, is the senior tournament I watched where this English golfer, 55-year-old gray-haired Englishman that most people, you know, wouldn't know the name today, was talking about how many golf balls he hit into the lake on 18 before he finally managed to stumble in with an 80-something. And the funny part was he jumped in the water at the end shouting, you know, three balls in the water, might as well make it five.
There you have it. So anyway, here I'm going to tell his tale. I digress. Anyway, so there's a fellow. He's apparently a rookie on tour. Mm. And he is right there with the leaders, a three-way tie at the top. And our rookie is on the tee, and Ben Wright, who's the one of the commentators, and he's got the English accent.
Stiff upper lip.
And he says, this young competitor who's fought and clawed his way all day long to stay with the leaders, what an amazing show of composure and patience. And he's held himself together all day long. It's been an amazing thing to watch. And I, as a commentator, I'm heartened by this show of composure and perseverance.
Wait for it.
And here, and all while he's saying this, the fellow's lining up his drive and getting ready. And he says, finally, perseverance to the end. And the fellow swings, and the ball evidently doesn't go what he wants to do. And he lets out this, and begins beating the tee box with his driver. And of course, Rice says, let's go to 16.
Back to you, Bob.
You couldn't have timed it better.
Bob, back to you, Bill. Over to you, Jim.
We're going to leave it with you for a while, Ben.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.